Argument this morning is Norfolk Southern Corporation against Ace Bermuda Insurance. Mr. Ball.
May it please the court, I am Robert Long representing Norfolk Southern. The issue in this case is whether federal courts are authorized by 28 U.S. Code Section 1782 to assist in collecting evidence for foreign commercial arbitration proceedings. We submit that the statutory language and the Supreme Court's recent Intel decision both lead to the conclusion that district courts have this authority. Legislative history and policy concerns, to the extent they are relevant, point to the same conclusion. The key statutory language, and it's reprinted at page A42 in the appendix to the blue brief, states, and I'm quoting, "The district court of the district in which a person resides or is found may order him to give his testimony or statement or to produce a document or other thing for use in a proceeding in a foreign or international tribunal." So the key language to be construed is a foreign or international tribunal. The ordinary meaning of tribunal is a court or other adjudicatory body. That's Black's Law Dictionary. An arbitral body is clearly an adjudicatory body. It carries out the same adjudicatory functions as a court. And there are many, many examples of arbitral bodies being referred to as tribunals. The Supreme Court and other courts have referred to arbitral bodies as tribunals more than 600 times by our count. Commentators going back to Blackstone and Story have referred to arbitral bodies as tribunals, and arbitral bodies themselves, including the arbitral body in this case, typically refer to themselves as tribunals. So we think the ordinary meaning of the term tribunal clearly includes an arbitral tribunal.
In all of these examples, I'm curious, what is the enforceability of whatever comes out of the arbitration? And secondly, related, do most of these examples have an ultimate lodging in a court somewhere?
Well, that's a key question, because arbitration would not work unless the arbitral awards were enforceable in a court. And for essentially all of these cases, there is a statute. In this case, it's the UK Arbitration Act of 1996 that authorizes the arbitration. It governs the arbitration in various ways. And once the arbitral tribunal issues its decision, it's enforceable in courts around the world because of treaties and statutes adopted by many countries, and indeed, an award of a foreign or international arbitral tribunal is typically easier to enforce than a judgment of a national court.
I guess I need to focus on whatever this is a private tribunal.
Well, that is a key point made by the other side, but our position is, first of all, that the statutory language, foreign or international tribunal, really doesn't suggest any distinction between a governmental body or a non-governmental body. But second,
the governmental body, it almost always has some enforceable or some ultimate resolution if there's still a dispute in a court. That's all. That's really my only question. Where does this one go when the arbitration is completed, someone still disputes?
It could go to virtually any court in the world.
To enforce a contract or what?
To enforce the arbitrator's award. It's treated just as a judgment of a court, and because of treaties and statutes, it will be enforced as such by courts of the United States, courts of the United Kingdom, and courts of dozens and dozens of countries. Which is why we think, commercial arbitration is very important. It serves a very important function, and governments have recognized it, and they support it. So that's why we think it's entirely reasonable to interpret the statute according to the ordinary meaning of its terms and to recognize that an arbitral tribunal is a tribunal. It is covered by the language of the statute. We think the Supreme Court's recent Intel case sheds light on the question before this court. First of all, the court did quote Professor Smith, who made a statement that the term tribunal in this statute includes arbitral tribunals. So they actually quoted that language. That issue was not directly before the Supreme Court, so it is dictum, but when the Supreme Court speaks in dicta, it speaks loudly. But perhaps more importantly, in the Intel case, the Supreme Court was repeatedly asked to adopt categorical limitations on this statute, on Section 1782, that were thought to be a good idea. And the court repeatedly said, we won't do that if the limitation is not in the...
I'm worried, quite apart from the language of the statute, about the fact that arbitration is commonly used to get away from expensive U.S. discovery regimes. And it wouldn't serve that purpose very well if you, having agreed to arbitrate, then go and do all the expensive discovery anyway. What does this contract say about discovery, either directly in language or by choosing a set of rules under which to arbitrate?
The insurance contract, which includes the arbitration agreement, it's in the record. It's in the Ace Bermuda response, and it's attachment A. And it says that any dispute or controversy shall be arbitrated pursuant to the UK Arbitration Acts of 1950, 1975, 1979, and subsequent ones. There has been a subsequent one. It says that arbitrators will be appointed by the High Court of Justice of England and Wales if the parties can't manage it for themselves.
What does the UK Arbitration Act say about discovery?
Well, there is a reference to discovery in the agreement. I'm too slow answering your question, Your Honor, but it says that the Board of Arbitration may prescribe reasonable rules and regulations governing the course of the arbitration proceeding, including, without limitation, discovery by the parties. And in this case, the arbitral tribunal in London has issued an order saying that they have no objection to this limited gathering of evidence and that they will consider it and give it the weight that they deemed to be appropriate if the U.S. court assists in gathering it. So
that's kind of a weak order.
Yes.
That they have no objection to it.
Well, I would submit, I mean, that's the way that a U.K. QC, an arbitration panel, would issue this. In the U.K. law, it's either approves or has no objection to. I think that's as good as it gets from a U.K. arbitration panel.
This is just British reserve rather than some doubt about the propriety of the discovery.
And there's a transcript of the discussion, which if you're interested, you can see. And I think the members of the panel do, with appropriate British reserve, indicate some interest in this. But Chief Judge Easterbrook, the district court has discretion to deny or limit the assistance, and the Supreme Court's opinion in Intel emphasizes this a great deal, and that is really a way that this can be kept under control. Most of the commentators, a large majority, agree that it is appropriate for U.S. courts to provide assistance to foreign commercial arbitration proceedings. They're very important. There are times when key evidence is really not available to them unless a U.S. court helps. And the ability of the U.S. court to exercise discretion under this statute and for the arbitral tribunal itself to exercise control, because it doesn't have to consider the evidence, and it can communicate with the U.S. court as the tribunal here has done. So we think all of those factors significantly limit the kind of mischief that could occur if this just became a sort of free-for-all, where anybody can come in and ask a U.S. court for a U.S. litigation-style discovery and arbitration. I agree that would be inappropriate, but I also think it won't happen. This statute has existed for 40-some years, and it clearly applies in lots of situations. There have not been serious problems. That's also pointed out by Justice Ginsburg in her opinion in Intel. So while that's certainly a legitimate concern, I think there are good answers to it.
So you haven't encountered the discretionary tripwire yet. So this is taken out based on no authority.
Yes. I mean, Judge Bucklow held that she had no authority, and I think quite properly just stopped at that point and left it up to this court to address that issue. But if this court were to hold that, yes, the statute does give authority, then we'd have to get into the question of should the discretion that's clearly provided be exercised here to allow the discovery. We meet. Intel actually gives some guidance on this, too, and says, if the discovery is requested from a party to the arbitration, that's maybe a reason not to help, because the arbitral tribunal has a lot of control over the parties. Here we have a non-party, so that would be one reason why discovery ought to be allowed here. A couple of other factors in Intel, they not only declined to adopt these categorical limitations and relied on the discretion of the district court to limit this, but they also addressed the question of what is a tribunal under this statute, and they used a functional analysis. They actually held that the Competition Directorate General of the European Commission is a tribunal, which is, to me at least, a somewhat surprising holding, because that body is not normally thought of as a tribunal. It actually filed a brief in the Supreme Court saying, we don't think we're a tribunal, and we ask that you hold that we're not. But what the Supreme Court said, nevertheless, they said what the Competition Directorate General is doing when it considers an antitrust complaint is functionally adjudicatory. It decides whether to proceed. It can impose a penalty. And therefore, when it functions as an adjudicatory body, it is going to be a tribunal for purposes of this statute. So our submission is, if a body that is not thought of as a tribunal generally and doesn't think of itself as a tribunal is a tribunal for purposes of this statute, then an entity that is commonly thought of as a tribunal and that calls itself a tribunal should also be covered. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly, Mr. Long. Mr. Posen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'd like to kind of jump out of order and Judge Mannion, answer the question that you asked, which I think you were asking about enforceability of an arbitration that takes place in London. I think the critical factor here is not that it can be enforced, but it cannot be reviewed by a court in London or anywhere else under the contract of arbitration but for fraud or collusion. And that's something you haven't heard about the Intel case, is the functional test for the Directorate General was not just that it was a proceeding of first review, and that there was review then where they would follow on with the court of first review and then the European court. And that is one of the things that the Intel court focused on that made this fall within the purview of what is considered a tribunal. And that is something that every case in the Second District and the Fifth District, every case that has held that a private arbitration...
Circuit.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. The Second Circuit and Fifth Circuit have held that a foreign private arbitration panel is not a tribunal.
Has any circuit addressed this issue since Intel?
Yes, Your Honor. Give me one second here. You have to bear with me. I can't see you in my paper at the same time. The Sixth Circuit, Your Honor, in the El Paso case, on August 6th of this year, and I apologize in advance because the names of all these cases have foreign companies in them. I'm not sure how to pronounce any of them correctly, so I apologize. But on August 6th of this year, the Fifth Circuit ruled that the Supreme Court in the Intel case had not specifically overruled the prior Biederman case, and therefore that its prior ruling that private arbitration is not a tribunal under 1782 was still in effect, and it followed its prior precedent. If I can speak, Judge Mannion, I want to go back to one more question you asked. I go back to that question one more time. The arbitration in London, could it be enforced today in the United States?
I've just looked up El Paso online. It's an unpublished order. It's non-precedential and doesn't count for a hill of beans. Is there any Court of Appeals that has actually addressed this issue in a real binding opinion since Intel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't make the distinction. No circuit court has issued a binding published ruling since Intel.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. The point I was going to make about enforceability, at the time that 1782 was amended in 1964, the arbitration would not have been enforceable in the United States because at that time, and this goes to the writings by Mr. Smith, who's cited in all the briefs, at that time the U.S. had not signed into the New York Convention, which would allow the enforcement of arbitrations in countries, and in fact the U.S. Delegates had raised questions about whether the U.S. should. And so at the time that 1782 was modified to assist foreign and international tribunals, the U.S. would not enforce a ruling by a private arbitration.
I'm now completely lost.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Enforcement of arbitral awards didn't depend on the New York Convention. There were common law precedents before the New York Convention about the enforcement of foreign arbitral awards, just as foreign judicial awards are enforced without any convention. There's no treaty. There's no equivalent to the New York Convention for the enforcement of foreign judicial decisions. But they're enforced in this country.
Your Honor,
why would one think that no foreign arbitral award could be enforced here without the New York Convention?
Well, Your Honor, I apologize if I misspoke. That was my understanding from the articles, both by Mr. Smith and by Mr. Rothstein. And I apologize if I misconstrued.
Well, had the Supreme Court held that they weren't enforceable before the New York Convention?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, in the at the time of the modification of 1782, the discussion and the discussions by Hans Smith as one of the authors and one of the authorities on the modification, all of the cases that cite to him cite to one particular footnote, and I think that's pretty critical because in the footnote he does include that arbitral panels, arbitral tribunals would be included within the term tribunal. But in explaining in this law review article, he cites to the Senate report that on why that bill was passed. And the Senate report, in fact, cites to the need to cooperate with international tribunals such as the International Court of Justice. And so nowhere in Hans Smith's article is there any mention of private arbitration. It mentions arbitral panels, but there have been arbitral panels around since the U.S. split off from Britain, and those reserved gentlemen had some issues with us, and those were arbitrated between countries. So arbitral panels and arbitral tribunals have existed, but in 1964, at the time that that 1782 was amended, there was absolutely no discussion in any of the reports or any of the description or the articles at that time. And Hans Smith wrote in 1965, shortly after it passed, there's no mention of private arbitration whatsoever. So that is something that I think is kind of a revisionist view of what that phrase meant at that time.
Well, I think the only thing that concerns me, because there isn't in the statute, it just says foreign or international tribunal without saying going on and say here's what a tribunal is and is not. You could have a situation like in the Catholic Church where they have a marriage tribunal, and it could be international, and that usually involves something about an annulment and somebody testifying, and somebody would not want to testify because they thought it was a legitimate marriage, and I'm not going to go in and say my kids aren't a legitimate marriage. But that's a marriage tribunal. I'm sure that doesn't have anything that goes beyond that, whatever they do in that tribunal.
I agree, Your Honor, and in fact...
So I just want to make sure, because if someone attaches tribunal as kind of a nickname to something just because it sounds good, doesn't necessarily mean it comes under this. And that's where I'm trying to find out where the parameters are on a private tribunal.
Well, Your Honor, there is, again, in 1782 and in the drafting history of it, there's no mention of private tribunals. There is a significant discussion of tribunals, but those are all about foreign tribunals being... And by the way, as far as the ambiguity of tribunal, before this case, I would have said it's unambiguous. It means a court, which is what my older law, Blacks, says, not the 2004. So if we start going back to what that meant in 1964, when the statute was written, I would have said it means a court, period. Now, in context of this, I have to shrug and say I can understand why all these courts have gone to legislative history and gone to dictionaries, because it doesn't seem to fit what I would have thought was the clear meaning of it. So I do think that the courts were correct when the courts have found that there is some ambiguity here. And then looking at the legislative history, it becomes clear that all of those modifications in 1964 were directed toward assisting either international tribunals such as those under the sanction of the United Nations, or foreign tribunals being governmental courts or quasi-judicial bodies. The Second and Fifth Circuits, and frankly the district court rulings that have ruled that a private arbitration panel is not a tribunal, and I'll step back just for a second. The fact that the Supreme Court said that the Directorate General, even though it says it's not a tribunal, is, the converse of that is, if this arbitration panel says it's a tribunal, that doesn't mean anything either. These are the same gentlemen that call a flashlight a torch. We use different names, different terms. They like to call themselves a tribunal, but that's not how the U.S. Code should be interpreted. The cases that have held that a private arbitration panel is not a tribunal, for the most part, have actually dug in beyond that one footnote that Hans Smith said, those two words, arbitral panel, and have actually gone back into the context of it, the context of the Senate report, and have focused on what was actually written at the time as opposed to what Mr. Smith may say that he remembers or what he meant years later. And even what he wrote in his article since then, he can only say what he thought or what he intended, but if that wasn't in the report and wasn't provided to the Congress, and it's not mentioned in the Senate report or the House report, even if that was in his head, that's not what he presented to Congress, and it's not what Congress adopted. So no matter whether he is considered the leading authority and the author of it, if that's not what he wrote in the statute and that's not what the Senate and the House adopted, it is not part of the law of 1782 as it was modified in 1964. And so the point I was trying to make is that those cases that have held that a private arbitral panel is not a tribunal have dug deeper than just that one phrase that was in footnote 71 of a 1965 law review article, and have actually gone back and taken it in context, and from that have concluded that that the private arbitral panels were never intended to be included.
Well, when you refer to review, the only way this is going to get reviewed is if there's fraud or something, some other obvious violation of whatever that's supposed to happen. I don't know.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was the point that Intel made, and that was one of the key distinctions on the functional test that the appellant brought up. That was one of the key factors of the functional test of a tribunal, is that it is the court or the tribunal of first review, and that is subject to review by another court or body above it. And so at that point, either an international tribunal having to do with the European Union or a foreign court has to have review, because otherwise what you have is you'll have the U.S. courts providing discovery for arbitral panels that answer to no one whatsoever. And that is
In this particular case, or whatever the contract says, it's there's no review unless there's some fraud or something.
Fraud or collusion by the board. So whatever the decision is, no matter how outrageous they may find a ruling on the facts, and I'm not saying that they would. I don't know these gentlemen, but the fact is, under private arbitration like this, there is no review by a court, and frankly, there's no review even in that case. When you would go to court and you would be claiming fraud or collusion, that's not even a review of the merits. It's a review of the activity of the board and whether they were being collusive or fraudulent. So in no case do the merits of an arbitration ever get before a court. And that is the key that the Supreme Court latched onto and said that was one of the key indicators of what would be considered a tribunal. And on that other subject, Your Honor, the appellant raised the question about whether the U.S. Supreme Court or the European Court of Justice, there's no court that would review them. There's never a doubt under 1782 that a court is a tribunal. It's the other quasi-judicial or arbitral or bodies that are not a court, and the question then is, when do we consider them a tribunal? So the idea that if there is not a court above the tribunal, it must not be a tribunal, that's just crazy when it comes to review by a court. If there are no other questions, I'll take my leave of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Posen. Anything further, Mr. Long?
Just briefly, we think this question of would a court review the decision of the arbitral tribunal is really beside the point. The reason that came up in Intel, we think it's clear, as we read the opinion, is because the court was explaining that what this competition directorate general did was adjudicatory. And to make that point, it was saying this really is part of a process that also has a continuation in an undoubted tribunal. But it wouldn't make sense to say that a tribunal is only a tribunal if its decisions are reviewed by another tribunal. That would leave out the Supreme Court. And so, we think that's just a non sequitur. There are, by the way, under the UK Arbitration Act, there can be judicial review for lack of jurisdiction, serious irregularity that affected the proceedings, or mistake of law unless the parties agree otherwise. Now, here they did agree to have less review. But, again, going back to our basic point, what really allows this entire process to function is that national statutes and treaties have provided for it, authorized it, and have said we will enforce the awards just as if they were judgments of a court, indeed, even more readily than if they were judgments of courts. I don't really know whether, what Professor Smith said in 1965 matters, but his article says in this footnote, the term tribunal embraces all bodies exercising adjudicatory powers and includes arbitral tribunals. So I'm not sure where this idea comes from that the point wasn't made in 1964.
The first part of that quote was not included in the Supreme Court's quote, was it?
That is true, and you can really get into tea leaves and start reading. Justice Ginsburg was an assistant to Hans Smith working on this project and did some sort of study, I think, of civil procedure in Sweden. She cites him many, many times in the opinion, always approvingly. I just think it's unlikely that they would have put in the quote about it includes arbitral tribunals if they had any real doubt about that. We have a theory that she was trying to focus on another piece of the language, but that's tea leaves. The final thing I'd say, there is a report of a committee of the Bar of the City of New York.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.